So next, I'd like to introduce Lynn St. Amour, who is the president and CEO of the Internet Society. She spends half her time in the ISOC office in Reston, Virginia, and the other half in the Geneva, Switzerland headquarters. And she has extensive experience in global IT business with positions at the highest levels of international sales and marketing, strategic planning, partner management, manufacturing, corporate restructuring, and startup management. So,
thank you, David. Truth be known, I spend about two-thirds of my life on an airplane, getting off them or getting on them. This is the last session of the day. I appreciate that there are still so many people in the audience. I know it's been quite a long day. I've had a great day myself in terms of listening to all the panelists and the speakers and lots of great questions coming in, and I'm sure this session will prove the same. I just have a couple of quick introductory remarks, and I want to ask each one of the panelists to comment specifically on the theme for this subject, and then we will open it up for general questions, either amongst the panelists themselves or from the room or back channel. So you will get one final chance to pose some questions. So this particular session was actually meant to debate the user-centric internet and the multi-stakeholder governance model. Specifically, the question was, can it persist in the face of what I would call often ever more aggressive government controls or business models? And if we believe that it can persist, what can we all do to support this? So first, I mean, the internet's helping to shape our future as a democratic global society by supporting fundamental human rights, such as freedom of opinion and freedom of expression. And I think that's been shown very amply in events over the last 5 or 6 months in the Middle East and North Africa. Clearly, empowering users is a key component of the internet's success, and obviously a lot of growth and activity in the world. At the same time, and I'm going to put a little plug in here for the D.C. chapter, on June 18th, there's another session. Sorry, did I say D.C. chapter? At the New York chapter. There's another event called Beyond the Bleeding Edge, Confronting the Ghosts in the Machine. And there's actually an announcement in your packet, but there's a great quote from Carl Sagan here, which I think has to get to some of the comments with respect to user-centric, and I think some of the complexities that we actually see in some of the discussions. The quote specifically is, "We have designed our civilization based on science and technology. We have also arranged things so that almost no one understands science and technology. This is a prescription for disaster. We might get away with it for a while, but sooner or later, this combustible mixture of ignorance and power is going to blow up in our faces." End quote. So given all this, and given the overwhelming support I think we heard in the room today for an open internet and freedom of choice and access and transparency, and the overwhelming pace of change, both technologically as well as what it's actually supporting in business models and in social developments as well. What are the panelists' reflections, a few minutes each from each one of you, with respect to the user-centric model, the challenges we're facing? Can and should the user-centric model persist? And if you still have the energy for that at the end, what do you think we might all do to actually support its continued development? I don't think I need to introduce the panelists. They've all been here today. I'm happy to start with Vint as the first and just go down the line.
So first of all, yes, the microphone works even if the little light doesn't come on. First thought is that I think about the history of the United States, and setting aside the American Revolution for just a moment as part of our history, which it turns out anonymous speech was quite important. Some people forget that. But when you look at pioneers and settlers and the general taming of the West, what happens is that the brave people go out to a place where there isn't any control, it's not terribly civilized, and those are the pioneers. Then things sort of settle down a little bit, and folks who are slightly less willing to accept risk go out and settle. but they're relying on a certain amount of law and order. And eventually, we create a more civilized environment. At least in democratic societies, there's a belief that safety and order are important to a successful society. In the internet world, we may be leaving the pioneer stage finally. It's penetrated fairly deeply. Maybe we're at a tipping point, maybe not. But it seems to me that the issues that we've been talking about all day today show that there needs to be more. I think users of the internet are understandably expecting an environment which is more predictable, about which they have reasonable expectations of safety and privacy. The question is, how can that be accomplished? I think the dialogue has to be multi-stakeholder, but I think that to the extent that we rely on legal systems in order to make our societies safer, that governments have an enormously important role at all levels, because that's what governments are supposed to do. In societies that are authoritarian, the freedom of speech is very much a threat. And what we saw during the Arab Spring or North Africa and the Middle East is an example of what happens in a non-democratic society when people are free to speak what they have to say. And you can see it led to substantial turmoil, social turmoil, and political disruption. And for some folks, that's a good thing, because it gained them a more democratic opportunity, a more democratic society in which to live. But you can be sure that some regimes will continue to feel that this is a threat. I think in a democratic society, we have to have both rules and law, and we have to have freedom to speak, and somehow have to balance those. So there's a role here for all the parties to play.
Well, to the question as to whether the user-centric internet can and should persist, I give a resounding yes to both. I certainly agree with Vince's observations about the evolution we're going through now, but the demands of the public for a predictable and safe internet, I don't think in any way conflict with the model we're talking about. So what we have to do, I think, are three things. One is we have to value what has gone before. We have to keep talking about how we got to where we're at today, the institutions that got us to where we're at, and keep reminding people that this has not been a case where this all happened, you know, without any human intervention. In a speech I gave a year ago, I raised strong objections to the term internet ecosystem because of the idea that it gives this conception that things just take care of themselves. And that's not the case. What we are where we are at today because of the involvement of so many people through the institutions that exist to get to the state we're in. Now, granted, it was not one of top-down government regulation, and for that we should all be thankful. But it didn't just happen by itself. It happened because of the organizations that have served us so well. So, number one, we have to keep talking about how we got to where we're at and why it's so important. Secondly, we need to be very vigilant about the threats as they arise to the existing models. And we have to look for them even in places that are uncomfortable, because some of these very unintentionally can arise in our own country. It doesn't just happen from foreign governments hitting a kill switch on the internet in Egypt. There are things that every day we see, and we are being asked to take actions that one has to ask, how do they fit in the overall scheme? Gigi talked about her work on Protect IP. Very troubling provision that's been laid out in that law, and while the administration hasn't yet established a position on it, quite obviously it's something that requires a lot of study, and we have to understand before we engage in some of those tactics as a nation exactly what it means. What are we losing when we do things like that? And then third, and this is, I think, something that I take as my responsibility as a government official, is we have to work very closely with other like-minded governments to preserve the model. And this is underway. I think the OECD effort that that the United States has largely been, the prod on, is a good example of getting governments together to talk about these issues and to keep perpetuating and promoting some of these concepts. So, but it takes everybody working in this area, everybody being vigilant, and everybody understanding the issues as they arise. And I guess if all else fails, we have happened to do carpet bombing. So.
User-centered. So when the user-generated content bit of Web 2.0 took off and it became sort of the stuff of all the conferences discussing what is really, really cool about the current web, I think this it was seen very glamorously as though user-generated content was had put the users in charge. And I think recent years, people have looked and realized that the users are in sheep mode, that they're sort of grazing and they're providing fertilizer to the grass, but they're not in charge. So when you what do you mean when you talk about user-centric? It's a contradiction in terms, because the users are the people on the outside. I do believe very much in the internet, which happens on the edge, and I see the users at the edge. I'm concerned that you can't. It's not just a question of saying we should put the users in charge. I think we needed a whole lot more Eblen Merglins, but all the same, it's not just a question of. It's not just a question of creating a revolution in the sense of destroying things. Revolutions. Well, what do you think of revolutions? It depends on which side you're on. I noticed. You referred to this the American war, which had happened differently. I suppose the victors refer to themselves as patriots. It would have been the patriotic military amphibious peacekeeping force, which had landed on the East Coast, had they won, and they would have been going up to Lexington and Concord in order to seize under insurgent sniper fire to seize the insurgents' stockpile of weapons. And if you read it with your so it depends very much which side you look, which glasses you look at it. Which is the revolution? Which is the revolutionary and that you support? And which is the revolution that you don't? And we are not always good at picking these. So when we build a multi-stakeholder system to run the world, yes, I agree, it's reasonable for it to be multi-stakeholder. Why? What does that mean? That means there are all kinds of organizations of different shape involved in making the decisions, and that means that you've got a certain amount of safety line there in case one shape of organization fails. If you build a completely government-controlled thing, if your government system failed, as it did, in a very carefully constructed system in the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union communist system, which was put together, carefully designed by well-thinking people in order to work, but it failed. Other systems, I think, equally well, we could design other user-based systems which also fail. And I think Wikipedia is frantically always trying to revise its own process. Things like the IETF and WCC are always should be revising their own process. So the one of the, multi-staker itself isn't magic dust. It means that we've got several strings to our bow. It means that if the governments are very badly behaved, then the more anarchic factors or the NGOs can then get together and be seen to be the voice of reason. But just as people started to assume that the blogosphere would keep the press, would hold the press accountable, now they're starting to wonder who's going to hold the blogosphere accountable. This is not simple. These are not simple questions to ask. So who's in charge as we build? How do we build? We do have to build structures. Yes, we do need to look at the way we've come from. We don't need to assume that the systems we have in the future have to be the same shape as the ones we've had in our old geographic-based past. But we do have to change very, very carefully. Because so many times, when you look back at countries whose societies have failed and produced something very nasty, which endured for quite a long time, that gives me sufficient pause for thought that I'm concerned now that we are doing again. We are trying now to construct a society. We call it the multi-stakeholder one, maybe. But it's got a new tag on it. But this time we're trying to do it for the planet. And so we've just got one go. So if we construct our process and it goes really horribly wrong, then there's no other country across the sea which is going to sail in and bomb us to pieces and take over and restore order. Okay, so we have to give ourselves some ground rules about moving carefully, and some metrics that each system as we go on is meets metrics of respect and being and democracy, and so on. I don't know whether we have enough combined experience through all this history that we can look back on to give us the wisdom to do it properly.
Do you mind if we continue?
Please continue.
It's not what you think. I have three points I want to make. First of all, those of you who will remember Marshall McLuhan will remember that one of the terms he used was the global village. And he was referring, I think, to a lot of connectivity that wouldn't otherwise be available. But I don't know how many of you have lived in small villages, but I spent 6 months living in a little town of 3,000 people in Germany, Beutelsbach. And I can tell you there wasn't any privacy there for two reasons. First, everybody knew everybody else, and the postmaster not only saw all the mail, but he had to place all the phone calls because this was in 1962. Nobody had phones in their homes. They had to go to, so he knew what everybody was doing. So when you think global village, you know, we've returned to an earlier era in some sense. Second point is this, the transformational effect of having access to information. Court cases in this country are considered public documents, and they are not necessarily all that easy to get to in the past, and when they were paper and you had to go in and get to a filing cabinet and so on. But if they are all online and all readily searchable and everything else, a lot of the information that's in those court cases, despite the fact that we treated them as public, have a lot of personal information in them which could be used for identity theft and a variety of other things. So the point here is that the technology transforms our view of what should be public and what should not be public. And the last point I wanted to make is just generally about Internet. There's a story told about a house built by a programmer. And the theory was that if you pulled any nail out of the house, the whole house would collapse. And we probably have a few nails in the Internet that could be pulled out, and that would not be a good thing.
So I just want to, I'm going to ask one more question, and then there's a number of questions coming in through the back channel. Those of you that are participating, if you want to vote on them, most of them are not getting any votes, it will help to increase some interest in, and I will take questions from there first before going to the floor, just to swap it about a bit. One of the things we hear when we talk to policymakers and when something happens in the Internet or to users that makes somebody uncomfortable, the first reaction often is to tighten down or restrict or control or look at policy or legislation. One of the hardest things we have is to explain that we would all be better off if they would lean into the open Internet and the values and principles that gave us the Internet in the first place, that is the most robust response, if you will, to some of those challenges, and that it supports innovation, multiple voices. This is sort of a call out to everybody in the audience, and I'm interested as whether or not there are any comments from the panelists. Any help you can give us and how we can actually make those responses and make this open Internet model and the things we all value and frankly are quite intuitive to us accessible to so many other people. I mean, many, many people, has been said over the course of the day, really don't understand, don't think about it, aren't concerned about the things we think they should be concerned about. And I think it's because we just can't make some of these principles accessible to the average person. So that's sort of a call out to everybody now or later. And in particular, if there are any sort of quick responses from the panelists, I'd love to hear them.
Right. Well, let's go back and talk about privacy, and we'll use this as an example for any number of Internet policy activities. One of the things, and this is a role government can play, and indeed it's the role that, we have set out in our privacy green paper, is the idea of the government facilitating or convening the resolution of some of these issues. So think if we had an environment existing now such that every time one of these privacy issues emerges from the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, that if one of the first things that could happen would be stakeholders immediately coming together to discuss the issue, work it through, and perhaps, in a very short period of time, having some statement of conduct emerge from that sort of discussion through this multi-stakeholder process, I think that would go a long ways toward validating what we're trying to do, as well as perhaps reduce some of the pressure, the natural response of politicians, which is there ought to be a law and call a hearing and bring people in. Part of this is because we don't have in place some of these other processes that could serve to show that people are coming together, trying to work to resolve these issues and actually getting results and implementing them. And that's what we'd like to be doing in privacy. Similarly, if anyone's looked at our cybersecurity paper from last week, it's what we want to do on cybersecurity. And there's any number of internet policy issues where these processes, I think, go a long way toward reducing the current reaction, which is in the absence of some other mechanism taking hold that's has the imprimatur of enough of the participants, that the natural call is for regulation or legal action. But I think it's because we don't have a well-defined alternative.
So I certainly endorse the idea of having that multi-stakeholder conversation. I must confess that from time to time I get the impression that our legislators are good at only two things, passing laws and passing gas. And which order, right? And you never know which is which. One of the hardest things I think which confronts the legislative world is understanding enough about the mechanics of the internet or how it's used to really pass laws that make sense. And here it's, I blame us in the technical world for not doing a better job of conveying in terms that are understandable how things work, what's possible and what isn't possible with the present instantiation of the system. This isn't to say that it couldn't evolve in some direction that would make it better from the legislative point of view, but it has to evolve and you have to understand what those evolutionary needs are. So my sense is that we have work to do in that domain.
Laws have this problem that they tend to be like various things nationally based. And certainly working with open government data, I've found that government data, of course, also is nationally based. And getting somebody to talk about putting their data out there, people talk about open. They'll have great enthusiasm. Sometimes they'll have great funding. And they'll have great projects, and they will actually end up producing wonderful open data projects. However, there's absolutely no way in which they can think or be paid to think about how this data is connects to something outside in another country. So, when things are done nationally, changing the ethos so that actually doing your bit so that it fits in. Yes, working out what the national law would be is all very well, and probably the best thing to do is to do a national one and then try and figure out how they connect together internationally, because that's the only way to do it in a reasonable amount, to be able to respond in a reasonable amount of time. But just to have always anybody who's working for a national government in the back of their mind, and have us just to spend a certain amount of time, spend 5% of your time talking to people who are doing the same thing in other governments, please. And if you're producing data sets, certainly talk to them about whether they're doing it in, maybe you want to actually do it in Celsius, not Fahrenheit. Little things. Talk to them about data structures so that when you've released your climate change data, we can put it together with climate change data for other countries, because really it's actually the climate change data for the planet we're interested in at the end of the day.
Could I, you don't mind if we go on a little bit more? Let me argue a little bit about the do the national one first and then do international, if I've understood you correctly. And the reason I would resist that a little is that architecture counts. It creates interoperability and consistency. And so if you don't have some idea of how you want some of these ideas to work on a global scale, you may end up with such diverse choices of design of rules on a national basis that they don't fit together at all well. Now, our friends in Europe have an interesting situation because they are a two-layer architecture. They have the European Union and the Commission and so on, and they have the Parliament, and then they have the national administrations. And although I wouldn't say that what everything they do works necessarily well, there is at least the possibility that having a general European-wide model of things, which is then adapted on the national level, has a higher probability, at least from my engineering point of view, of working than a collection of independently arrived at practices and legal structures. So I guess I would kind of not want to have the international conversation delayed. I'd rather have it go on in parallel with some of the other national considerations.
Well, in fact, if we could pursue that, which is something I've thought about a whole lot because it's the philosophy upon which the whole sort of the web of data depends, is that, so you know, Vint, well, that standards are painful to make. They take a lot of time and effort. So, in fact, you pick your battles and you do standards where you have to. So that I think the sensible thing to do is to look at which are the things which are the columns in the databases which we really want to have. That what are the top pick? If you could have 100 columns agreed internationally, and then those would be done by an international group, which would those 100 columns be? And when you've got those, then you that will take quite a lot of time to get it done. And meanwhile, national initiatives will be stalling because they're getting fed up with being told to wait for the international standard to be ready. So that you only do that for things like latitude and longitude and start time and end time and GMT, things like that, that'll be standardized very quickly. And then you have other things which you do, not necessarily in national groups, but also maybe in smaller groups like the financial sector or the scientific sector. And you end up with these various sets of standards which come together. And then you sew them together like a quilt. And that actually happens in finite time. Whereas if you start at the top and try to make a standard for everything, then I think you end up with a balance between thing, and you're absolutely right when you have to have the overall architecture you have to have in mind from the get-go.
So you're caught in the middle of this debate here. I actually think that places like IGF, which will be coming up later this year, are a good venue in which to have discussions on an international basis from which you can harvest ideas. And so that's why I'm thinking about doing things in parallel. I want to keep harvesting those ideas that come out of this discussion that brings a lot of international perspectives together. So I hope we're not in complete disagreement that we should be able to pursue both of these things concurrently. Now, as the government representative, what's your reaction to all this?
Just watching.
I'm going to take one question from back channel, and then I'll go to the room. There were two tied, but one was in first and early. And that question was, what will the user-centric internet look like in 10 years when the internet is more ready to serve its next major constituencies or demographics, particularly those in India and China? And then there's a footnote which says China does not want multi-stakeholder model, by the way. And that was submitted from Liao. Comments?
There's quite a bit kind of mixed into that one long question. First of all, one thing that I think we still see today is a remarkable empowering of users of the internet, the ability to build apps, the permissionless innovation that takes place if you have essentially access to the network and can put up products and services without getting further permission from the access providers or even the backbone providers. I don't see that going away, unless there's some dramatic change in the way the network is managed, I believe that this openness and this freedom to try things out will continue to drive the network over the next decade. At least I hope so, because that's really been the core of the cornucopia of ideas that have come out of the net until this time. The question asked about India and China, and I'm actually quite fascinated by the Chinese situation because there are more Chinese on the Internet than there are in any other place in the world, 450 million and counting. And they make heavy use of it. So the view that we may have of the controls and the like from the perspective of a country with First Amendment rights here in the U.S. and the like may not be the same attitude that the Chinese citizens have, at least a lot of them. Some of them plainly want what we have. Others seem to be very comfortable with a more controlled environment. So I don't think, though, that that's going to stop user-centric experimentation from happening even in those countries, because as long as the technology is readily available, they'll still have an opportunity to try out new ideas.
Well, I think it's picking up some of these points. One of them is the hinting that some countries will try to take a lot of control, and I can imagine that we may end up with a free internet and within it areas which are very different and in which there's not so much good connectivity. And it may be that we just have to watch the, like so many walled gardens which have been created in the past, which looked to be such a good idea at the time but ended up being so stifling to anybody inside them. We might end up seeing some countries become very controlling about their internet, watch what goes on, restrict people's access to the internet and the ability to run servers, and we may find their economic growth slowing as a result of that compared to being part of what becomes really not another the rest of the international world. So I imagine we'll see various experiments of attempts to control it, but I imagine that the openness in the end will win. I think it will be fascinating when the as we get lots and lots of different languages on their web. Of course we do. One of the phenomena which I'm a little concerned about is this one of completely independent planes, that if you go to to Wikipedia and you look up Tiananmen Square, it's there in Chinese and it's there in English. When you look at it in English and Chinese, I gather that they're not they don't say the same thing, because there is a Chinese culture which not out of coercion but just out of and maybe out of tact, but there is a more gentle reporting about of Tiananmen Square, and when it's done in the Chinese in the Chinese language, and maybe we'll end up with, but due to the language differences, these two different cultures which end up becoming international, but not actually touching each other. Of course, really interesting questions. The technology side is: will Google end up just translating it all? Google, I think, turned off the. We had a chat, an internet relay chat server in WTC, which we were prototyping. Dave Raggett wrote one, which would just translate it into everything that was said into your local tongue. It was using the Google Translate API, and I think the Google Translate API got turned off. So that's no more. But the idea, this, which has been always just around the corner of machine translation, is really interesting. And there's a neat project somebody has done to put next to each other Wikipedia projects, which are Manipedia, that allows you to go and look at Wikipedia in different languages just to see how, that is to say, look at it in your language and look at it in another language automatically translated, to the extent that that works, as an attempt to just sort of build bridges between these different planes.
So on the 10-year question, I won't answer that. It's totally speculative, and if I got asked that in Washington, I'd say call Vint Cerf or Tim Berners-Lee and see what they think. Heard what they think. But I will make two observations. First is, I think we have to be very careful that we don't take actions that in some way hasten or create a pathway to balkanization and fracturing of the internet. I mean, ICANN was established with the goal of preserving a single internet. And yet we are quite concerned, and I've stated this publicly, that this rush to expand top-level domains without understanding government reactions to it in effect creates an opportunity under which governments will think they legitimately now have that there's now an expectation that they can take actions to block at the top level, which could, if unchecked, could lead to some balkanization of the internet that we'd all regret, which is why we have been so focused on this issue as one where there needs to be a process to try to preserve the single internet and creating a really meaningful objections process for governments, with the goal not just to give governments a chance to object, but in this higher value of preserving the single internet. And related to that, I will just share an anecdote with you, which is we met with the Chinese vice minister in charge of communications and the internet a few months ago, and we took him through some of the policymaking principles that, you know, guide us here in the United States, and we talked about free expression. And his response quite directly was, in China, we believe in free expression, too, of lawful content. Now, whether you think he was being disingenuous or not, clearly we have some differences in terms of what's lawful content to be expressed. But at least we are using terminology that we can share and we can talk about. So perhaps there is some hope here that by continuing to engage all of these nations and continuing to get a lexicon of terms with the meanings that attach to them that we can share, maybe there is hope that we can find a way to navigate our way through this through the next 10 years. It's not going to be easy, but we've got to be talking to other countries. We've got to be pointing out, again, we've got to be telling the story. China faces a lot of economic issues right now, and I'm sure that the idea of the internet being an economic engine for them is very important to their economic planners. And it's just a question of how do we get their other policymakers comfortable with perhaps more freedom of their citizens to express themselves, recognizing the trade-offs. It's a tough issue, but I don't think it's one we should give up on.
Several things immediately come to mind. I remember a conversation that was related to me about the discussion on freedom of expression in Russia during the Soviet period. And the Americans said, you know, in America, we're free to criticize the president. And the Russians said, well, we're free to criticize your president here, too. I mean, so, you know, what's the problem? I wanted to come back to a term that you despised to be extreme. That was internet ecosystem. And I want to suggest to you that there are at least one interpretation of ecosystem is that it is not without rules. These ecosystems evolve in accordance with conditions and pressures and mechanisms and so on. So it's not exactly unconstrained. I know you wanted to focus on the man-made structures that have involvement of people in their evolution, but just for a moment, think about the internet as an evolving technology. Think about its impact on social and economic structures. There is a kind of co-evolution which I think will arise out of this. The change in economics, for example, going from paper to online, is dramatic, at least in some industries, newspapers and magazines and the like. It has a big impact. And I think that the internet will have these social and economic effects, and we will evolve management and governance structures in reaction to that. So part of our task is, if we have to craft what some of the evolutionary responses are, since you're quite right, they don't just happen. But we have to recognize that it is an evolving system and that there isn't a single solution. It's going to be something we have to keep up with because it's going to continue to innovate and it'll continue to have surprises.
Which is why we love it. Go to the room now. There's a gentleman back there. trying to get some new voices in here as well.
Hi, I'm Tom Lowenhaupt. I'm the director of Connecting.NYC, Inc. We're a not-for-profit, New York State not-for-profit, advocating the development of the .NYC top-level domain as a public interest resource. And I learned today that the city is going to be sponsoring a website, nycshare.org, it's not quite ready yet, that will enable all of the ISOC members within the room here to participate in thinking about how the .NYC TLD will be shaped. So we have this whole new ecology, if I may use a term that's good or bad there, within which we can figure out how we govern an internet resource. And I'm wondering, my question is, from those on the panel, whether they have any thoughts on the multi-stakeholder model or what the appropriate model might be for a city TLD, considering that city TLDs also have a possibility, at least in the case of New York, for a regionalization impact. Thank you.
Well, I don't have a specific response for .NYC because I don't know whether any other community would share an interest in that top-level domain besides the parties who are here in New York, although those who want to market to New York City residents might want access to that top-level domain. I have talked to the .Berlin people who have been pushing for that top-level domain for quite a while. They made a change in policy, or at least they made a policy more clear to me recently, that they thought others who also had claim to the term Berlin, for example, I guess Iowa, is it? That has, New Hampshire has a Berlin? Yes, okay. So they said that they would welcome participation by those other parties who had reason to claim that name. So I think here, if you're going to do a top-level domain like that, one of your challenges will be to make it useful. And my guess is that, we will experience a number of top-level domains as this process unfolds that don't turn out to be useful, but we may not know that ahead of time. We certainly discovered some of the other top-level domains that were introduced by ICANN since 2000 had varying degrees of success and uptake in the community. So anyone who believes that having a large number of new top-level domains of any kind, city and otherwise, will generate a guaranteed explosion of economic value probably should be a little more cautious in their expectations. You're doing an experiment because we haven't had any top-level city names before, so you should treat it that way.
Another question? Can I go to the back of the room there, which I think, apologies to those that I'm not going through, but I'm just trying to get some new voices and questions in.
Hello? Is it on? Oh, okay. Sorry, I'm not necessarily a new voice, I'm Sean from Startup here in New York City, called HERE, trying to enable the Internet Street Address top-level domain, which actually is the island of Sao Tome, which is marketed by a Swedish registry as the Internet Street Address domain. So, before this TLD existed, I thought, oh, well, that would be a great place to route through cities, states, streets, towns. So one thing that I came up with figuring that out is what Vint brought up, this idea of sort of an easement for someone else named another entity that has Berlin, a right to Berlin. This idea of easement through domains, I think, Sir Tim, it relates to linked data and the semantic web and sort of creating accessibility and understandability with domains and URIs. So if we can create these URIs or URLs or domains that are understandable both by humans and also parsable by machines through easement of those domains to create linked data, then perhaps we have this way of communicating technology. And that was just so much I said, I'm sorry. But in general, linked data, semantic web, and the new top-level domains, do we have an opportunity here to make technology more accessible to regular people?
I think people know well that my first my immediate response to any top-level domain is why? No. Why? No. As Vince said, you can, when you look at this piece of real estate, and you see, imagine that you're running Linden Labs and you're looking at all this virtual, this really valuable stuff, which you've created, and you create it out of, all out of bits. And so when you look at the fact that, oh, there's so much value represented in the .com, so much business is going on, and oh my goodness, if we could just make a .com too, then we double it. That is a little, kind of a little bit of a fallacy going on there. It's pretty much the same as if you look at all the banknotes in circulation, you think, oh, there's a lot of value in those. Each of the dollar bills is worth a dollar. If we just printed exactly the same number, we'd have twice the amount of value. So no, you wouldn't. You'd have half the amount of value in each one, roughly. Not rough. So the idea that you need to create... you need to just make... we're running out of room in .com. Is silly, because every time you add, every time you say that this year we're going to be, it's going to be cool to have slightly longer domain names by a factor of one letter, then you get that it thing grows by a factor of 26, and that's only ASCII, and you've got Unicode. The idea that it's running out of names, domain names, is a ridiculous argument too. So what's interesting is if you say I'm going to come with a completely new philosophy and a completely new business model and a completely new I'm going to build a piece of the domain name system which will be in a way a whole lot better for a whole lot of people, and for do that I need a top level domain because I need to have a completely different contract. So for example, I have something I have been in favor of is if you come along and say I want .archive or .permanent, and you come along to ICANN and say, look, ICANN, we're fed up with these things that you rent out. We're not going to rent them out. We're going to make them, allocate them permanently, and we're going to have a whole lot of social structure, and we're going to put together so that these things never die, and they're only used for websites which have information which will be offered up under an open license under the company. So to do that, we have to completely have a different contract. We're not renting them. We're actually allocating them in perpetuity. That sounds like a reason for a top-level domain to me. No, but because it's cute, preserve us. I mean, hands up for people who use .ly. Hands up people who use, who tweet using the tweet and end up getting their things shortened to something .ly. Nobody? Yes, you do. Come on, don't you? How many of you realized that meant you were rooting logically through? You were rooting your name, the trust, through Libya? How many people fall, I think you probably did realize that there was Libya involved, but very lot of people didn't realize that Libya was involved. They just thought, oh, that's cute. It comes out as al.ly. That's like an adverb.
I think we just let it stop there.
Right. I think it's for semantic if it's an adverb. You don't even want to express it in language.
When you're expressing semantic, the way the semantic web works is it does not encode information into the names. The names do not themselves encode information, so that you can allocate a name and then change what you say about it. So, in fact, not encoding information into the URLs. In fact, web architecture in general is that the URIs are to first order opaque. So I'm not very.
You're going to avoid. One more response from Vint and one more question, and then unfortunately we're going to have to wrap it up. But Vint, please respond.
Just one small observation. The domain name system, when it was first designed, was very much bound to computers and destinations on the net. And the natural binding to specifically an IP address came out simply from the way in which the system was designed. It may very well be that creative uses of identifiers shouldn't use that particular paradigm, that there could be alternative ways of identifying objects that don't necessarily rely on having any idea where the object might have been at any one time. The fact that domain names are not necessarily stable is a real concern. If you've ever written a paper and you made references to URLs and then later tried to find them as you look at the paper years later and they don't resolve because the domain name has been abandoned, or worse, it's been taken over by somebody else, and you go to what you thought you were going to and what shows up isn't what you were expecting. So the only reason I'm chewing up some of your time on this is to simply suggest that creatively speaking, we should be thinking about a full range of possible ways of identifying things of interest and binding them to where we can find them now, and maybe hoping to bind them in a way that's more permanent. So this isn't to say we should abandon the domain name system, but it might be that we would benefit from an alternative kind of design.
So one more question. Is there a question specifically to this topic, since I don't think we really have time for another front? So then you've had your hand up. And then while the microphone comes, I'd like to then ask the panelists. I mean, I think it's appropriate. We have such an esteemed panelist here. If you want to take 30 seconds or a minute to give any final sort of thoughts or...
Yeah, my name is Parvinder, and my question, all three of you, is what was your reaction to WikiLeaks?
Okay.
Yeah. Follow-up of sorts.
I actually had two schizophrenic reactions, to be quite honest with you. My first reaction was that the leak was done by somebody who had been trusted and was not trustworthy. Now, you can make arguments about whether this was a good or a bad thing to have done, and of course the Pentagon Papers are what could now be considered a counterexample. But my first reaction was that person really violated trust. The second reaction was the people who put the information into the system without paying any attention to access control showed a certain level of, stupidity or ignorance, not understanding that the material, which in many cases was pretty sensitive, was going into a place where it was more accessible than they realized. The last thing I would say is that in any of these incidents, sometimes there is value in the spotlight of transparency. And so, I was very schizophrenic in my reaction to all this. I think some of the things that were revealed were probably important for people to know, and other things less so. But here we are with a system that didn't perform the way it was supposed to.
Yes. A lot of what he said, and also a lot of what I said in response to the same question when it was asked at my keynote, more or less, that I talked a lot about anonymity, which is kind of which is related. In extreme circumstances, one needs the right to be able to blow a whistle under an oppressive regime, and I don't think in this case the leak counted. In my book, then I don't think that the guy's going to be excused, because in fact he was blowing the whistle on an oppressive regime and showing a light on human rights violations, that he was that in fact that was no it was an egregious breach of his employment contract. The other end of the scale, then, the question is, what about WikiLeaks, which is a site where you can put stuff? WikiLeaks, if it was just a site which allowed people to upload stuff in a way, would become, if they hadn't got a filtering service, then they would, in a way, be able to protest that they weren't in control, like a lot of sites, a lot of sites do, that just allow people to post things. The fact that they've got a that they do in fact look, they have a group of people looking at whether they're going to put such a thing out, I think suddenly makes them open to criticism. And to my mind, I think it. I want to preserve the rights of newspapers to. But when there is material which is public, once it has become public, then you should not criticize a newspaper for distributing it. And I think a website works like WikiLeaks to a certain extent, large extent, works like a newspaper. If the New York Times had done it, it would have been the freedom of the press. And so same sorts of things with WikiLeaks. When either a newspaper like the Daily Telegraph or the WikiLeaks releases the stuff in dribs and drabs so as to be sensationalist, then, for me, that loses some of the credibility which they had as doing something for the public good, and it suggests that they're doing it for their own advertising revenue, as opposed to when it's done in a sensationalistic way. So there are a huge number of different sort of feelings, one way or the other.
Thank you. Larry, would you like to respond to that question, or do you want to move to your 30-second concluding remarks?
There are people at higher pay grade levels than me who deal with WikiLeaks, so I don't think I should add anything to the discussion. And from the perspective of the U.S. government, I think it's pretty clear from what the response has been where the USG is at on that. In terms of a final summary, I think this has been a terrific discussion today. I'm thankful that I was able to hear, sit here and listen to much of it. It's always very helpful for me to get out and not just parachute in and give a talk and leave, but to actually be able to spend time and hear the issues that are being debated and discussed to get a better sense of where folks are at. My only, I guess, last thought is, everybody, please stay engaged. Please stay active on these issues. The community has to be heard on these, on all of these important issues. So you need to stay involved. You need to, you know, find other people to get involved as well. These are going to be difficult years, but I think we all have to pull together and work through these issues as we confront them.
Tim?
Bien. Keep up the good work. I think there are lots of areas where we need to keep jumping up and down to keep, for example, the net neutrality, openness of government data. Then everybody can push a little bit. There are some areas where we have to deploy technology, which, like, for example, Vint would call in his keynote for being able to do things with public keys, actually using this public key technology. So, for example, I'd love if everybody started using PGP, including my bank. There's stuff which we can... In some cases, there's some where it's sort of... clear that there are good things that we could do. Other places like privacy, where we have to design some systems, folks here, and we don't know. Maybe we haven't thought of maybe there's a really neat solution in a privacy system. We have to do research. It's not as though it's just a question of jumping up and down and shouting, we want better privacy. We have to continue lots and lots of discussions about like this, by what we mean by better privacy. We have to do lots of really creative engineering to invent really clever systems which give us the best of both worlds.
Invent is one of the fathers of the Internet as well as fathers of the Internet Society. We'll let you close out the panelists' comments.
None of which means I have anything useful to say, but... first of all, I really enjoyed the day. I mean, this is a good opportunity to wrestle with some hard problems. I think that our biggest challenge and our biggest obligation is to understand as deeply as we can what it is that has allowed the Internet to be such a vibrant source of new ideas and creativity, while at the same time trying to figure out how to make it a safer place for all of us to use. And those two things are so important to our descendants, so to speak, that we really are obligated to try to sort that out to make a system that will continue to evolve, but it will evolve in a way which makes it safer in which to operate.
Not only our descendants, of course, but the 4 billion people that aren't connected today. Catch them before we lose them. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to David and Sally, I think, to say goodbye and thank everybody. I'd simply like to take this opportunity to put a call out to everybody to be active, be vocal, actually help us forge the Internet of the future. And I'd like to recognize all the efforts of the New York Society chapter in particular.